we still had this very narrow view of what an entrepreneurial support organization should look like. You know, it should be an accelerator or an incubator, which is, you know, I have an idea and I want somebody who helps me bring the idea to the next level. Usually the support is 1 to 3 months. But after that, you're a little bit left on your own. And that's where what we sort of coined as the pacer or the pacemaker organization comes in.
That's our argument in terms of, you know, why you would like to become perhaps a more of a pacer is to offer more in-depth support, but also support through the ups and downs and intensive support where needed.
This is Mission to Scale, a podcast that reveals the tools, mindsets, and strategies that organizations and funders need to make the most impact, because the world's biggest problems need solutions at scale. I'm your host, Dan Borelowitz. In this episode of our special series with Stanford Social Innovation Review, or SSIR, we're exploring an emerging approach to entrepreneurial support through the concept of PACES. What are the benefits of supporting entrepreneurs beyond discrete programs? In emerging economies, how does the PACER model embody the entrepreneurial journey as a marathon, not a sprint? Sonali Ramahan and Tim Weiss, today's guests, elaborate on the ideas proposed in their SSIR article, Pacing Entrepreneurs to Success. On the show, we discuss the blueprint for helping entrepreneurs achieve their goals through pacemaker organizations. In this episode, Sonali and Tim also share the challenges of PACES and how this model can exist with traditional support for organizations.
What happened is during the pandemic, you know, at Stanford Seed, our entrepreneurs were going through a lot of ups and downs, as most, you know, business owners were.
That's Sonali, the evaluation and learning lead at Stanford Seed. Seed is an initiative led by the Stanford Graduate School of Business that's working to end the cycle of global poverty.
We were founded about 10 years ago, really with the mission to partner with entrepreneurs in emerging markets to build thriving enterprises that transform lives. And so our vision is to end the cycle of global poverty. And we believe there are many paths to impacts. You know, companies obviously can benefit their consumers and make their lives better as they grow. But it's really wonderful work. These are, you know, inspiring, energizing stories that we hear from our entrepreneurs throughout over 20 countries in Africa and South Asia. But they're typically small and medium-sized companies ranging from $300,000 in annual revenues all the way up to $15 million when they start with us. And they normally engage with us, you know, for quite a long time. But our flagship program is about 11 months long. And it's a high-touch, in-depth training program that works not only with the leader, but with the entire management team.
Throughout her career, Sonali has focused on the intersection of business and social change, exploring what the business sector can learn from the social sector and vice versa.
I think the interesting mix comes because most of my research is focused on entrepreneurs in Kenya.
That's Tim.
I was 2 years in Kenya working in rural areas. And then at some point in that journey, sort of realized that development aid may not be the right lever for me. I got quite burned out in doing this work. And it was interesting because in organizing a workshop in Kenya, I found myself in Nairobi and walked into the iHub, which is sort of the epicenter of technology entrepreneurship in Kenya. It's like a co-working space that really kind of formalized the community for the first time in a physical space around technology entrepreneurship. And so I found myself there and was exposed to a completely new image, if you will, of Kenya that I hadn't seen before. And I was very inspired and wanted to understand more. And so I did my PhD on that. I was, you know, dedicated my doctoral work to understanding how that entrepreneurial community came together, what's now called Silicon Savannah, you know, who are the major players. I published and co-edited a book on it that got published. And from there, you know, the interest sort of remained in wanting to understand how entrepreneurship works and what sort of the entanglement between entrepreneurship and society is that brought me to Stanford University as a postdoc. So you see the obvious similarity between Silicon Savannah in Kenya and Silicon Valley in the US, right? So I was fortunate enough to start a postdoc there. And that gave me a deeper understanding of how Silicon Valley operates. And so now my work's kind of like trying to put the two together, you know, to understand this new wave of internationalization, if you will, of the Silicon Valley model to a place such as Kenya.
In his work, Tim has tried to understand how entrepreneurs have tried to build and sustain their businesses and how they can scale up.
We still have this very narrow view of what an entrepreneurial support organization should look like. You know, it should be an accelerator or an incubator, which is, you know, I have an idea and I want somebody who helps me bring the idea to the next level. Usually the support is 1 to 3 months. You know, you get some mentoring, you get some coaching, you might get a little bit of money, you might get a co-working space. And then the accelerator kind of pushes you to the next stage. But after that, you're a little bit left on your own, if you will. And that's where then what we sort of coined as the pacer or the pacemaker organization comes in.
In their article, Sonali and Tim, alongside their co-authors Darius Teeter and Jasper Sorensen, propose an alternative type of support for emerging market entrepreneurs. Pacers, as they call them, serve entrepreneurs for the long run, from 1 year to a lifetime. Pacers tend to start by offering intensive short-term programs, like many other entrepreneurial support organizations. From there, graduate entrepreneurs go on to a long-term post-program support infrastructure. Entrepreneurs who work with Pacers receive 4 principal benefits: access to continuous learning, extended business networks, meaningful peer connections, and needs-based services. So in the US, clearly entrepreneurship has been in Silicon Valley has been successful to some extent, and we've made a number of billionaires and multi-billionaires, but it's led to sort of pretty rampant inequality. So you talked about SMEs. I'm wondering, if you are supporting tech companies across Africa, do you think about sort of creating unequal growth, concentration of wealth in a few versus supporting SMEs more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the debate, right? I mean, you could see, and we do worry about at Seed, you know, as we're scaling IT companies, maybe, you know, their revenue growth looks terrific, but, you know, maybe they're not creating lots of jobs. You typically would need fewer, you know, workers to get more out of your technology, perhaps, at your company. But ultimately, you're adding, you know, money to the local economy, and there are many kind of spillover effects of that. So I think that's a constant debate that we think about.
I think if I can just add to that, I think the philosophical question that you have hit on is, well, we are seeing Silicon Valley in a late stage, or we can observe it in a late stage. And what we are seeing is that rampant inequality is taking root, right? And we are now more aware of that than we were 10 years ago or 20 years ago. You have certain power concentrations that are going on. So how do we mitigate that? How do we ensure that that doesn't also take root in other economies? And I think that's a very important conversation to have. And it's also something that you start seeing, for example, in the example of Kenya, what you see is that a lot of technology-first companies are introducing new ways of giving credit, right, to mass consumers. And so what you see now is a gigantic spike in default rates because people are taking credit based on how they're using their phone, but then they're taking too much credit and they can't pay back, right? And so you have the gigantic default rates that have never been there before. Granted, nobody has counted them really before either, but you know, you see that that's going up as well. So you see the social consequences of this. And one conversation that might be interesting here is that there's a push to create a different type of entrepreneurial organization. And some call it the gazelle or the camel, I think is like another word, where it's not about rapid growth, right? Not the unicorn way, which is how can we get a $1 billion valuation the fast way possible, right? By growing the consumer numbers and whatnot. But then there is this, well, you know, if you go through the desert, you need a lot of water if you want to grow and make the journey fast. But, you know, why don't, you know, use the camel model? which is a slower paced growth, which is based on revenue, right? Where the idea is we're offering value to the consumer straight away from the beginning because they're paying for it, which is not trivial in a place where the purchasing power is extremely low, right? Like the key challenge is how do you offer a service to someone who basically has no money to pay for it, right? And if you're able to do that right from the get-go, you have solved a real pain point, right? And not just offered some fanfare product, right? And I think that is where I see the conversation going more and more. Can we deviate away from this hyper growth model that is in our face the entire time, if you will, right? Not just in positive, but also in negative news. And can we create something that's more sustainable and more adapted to the communities where you might go through a longer sort of time span of very limited growth, right? Which every venture capitalist would discount straight away. But maybe if we have a different organizational blueprint, if you will, then that could be acceptable and would be seen as part of the journey.
Would love to hear some examples where you've really seen entrepreneurial support make a difference to a venture.
Research is showing that entrepreneurial support is helpful in terms of building skills, but also getting access to new forms of capital and building your networks. But you know, just one example that we talk about in our article is a macadamia nut company in Kenya called 10 Senses. And their leader, Frank Omondi, you know, went through our program and, you know, had a successful macadamia nut exporting business, selling to countries around the world, organic nuts and other products, but really, you know, had some issues in terms of kind of the back end of the house, financial management. And so after going through the program, he had a great kind of transformation plan that he had developed in order to scale, but he had a real, you know, issue in terms of how to manage his cash flow. And that's where we had a Stanford coach that was assigned to him, who was, you know, an experienced kind of executive Stanford MBA alum, who really came in and helped him get his finances more in order and manage some cash flow issues. And the result of that was, you know, a few years later, he was able to secure some funding because of shoring up those finances. That's just one example, but I think what support organizations offer effectively can be just kind of, you know, in-depth assistance. I mean, that's our argument in terms of, you know, why you would like to become perhaps a more of a pacer is to offer more in-depth support, but also support through the ups and downs and intensive support where needed.
In your research, you identified 90 entrepreneur support organizations across Africa and India. Interested to know your findings, but in particular, why do you think there is still a gap in continued support if there are so many organizations providing support already?
Yeah, I think what we found is, you know, often there are just 1 week programs, 1 month programs, 2 month programs that may be focused on a specific issue, you know, building a business plan or getting ready for a pitch competition or honing your skills on financial management. They can be relatively targeted or, you know, more broad, but the key being, you know, thanks for participating in our program. And that's kind of it. Afterwards, you know, you might be part of sort of a loose alumni network, but we found that, you know, even other research is showing that there is a demand from entrepreneurs for more than that, and that long-term services are lacking. And part of it could be financing of, you know, offering more long-term services, that could be part of it. And so what we observed is just that the folks we interviewed, for example, they also, you know, sometimes started out with a very targeted program, but really saw an increased demand from entrepreneurs for other services. So at Stanford Seed, for example, we started with the main transformation program, but we saw a need to add on to that kind of coaching and mentorship. After you finish the program, a need for targeted tactical, you know, consulting once in a while, a need to stay connected to cultivate your own personal network over time. And I think it just kind of, you know, there is a benefit to ultimately growing into more of a global organization or regional organization where people then have a desire to connect with folks outside of their own state or their own country, you know, to grow their business. And so I think it just kind of, some organizations have made a concerted effort to evolve as they grow and then invest resources into providing more support beyond kind of a discrete training program.
And perhaps more broadly reflecting upon it, what you're seeing now is that a lot of the legacy businesses that have been there for quite a long time, for example, in Kenya, they're now receiving more competition, right? Like there has been so much focus on incubating new ideas, accelerating them in some way. But now you have these businesses that are post-revenue, they're profitable, they're working. And as Sonali has mentioned, maybe up to 15 million in revenue. But it's really sort of the question, okay, what's next? And who can help me in that next journey, right? So then I guess you could go to your consultancy services of McKinsey and alike to figure that out. But here it's really about a transformational journey, both for the leader and also for the organization and the executive team included, to in a self-directed fashion with information and resources, et cetera, to help you define those goals of what's next for us and then help you kind of be accountable to them and reach them. And I think the important part here is that sliver of post-revenue organizations or businesses is growing. There are more and more of these. And we're speaking about a super large space, right? Like the African continent, including then India and Southeast Asia. So this is like a gigantic mass of organizations that require high touch, high value knowledge transfer and access to resources. And I think that's also something that's really important here. Is the idea of high touch, right? Like this is not just a sort of, oh, here, watch a couple of videos and you'll be fine type of thing, right? Like this is, there is a personal engagement that goes deep into also understanding you as a leader.
And I would add that, you know, you could argue that the support kind of services market might be less developed in the regions we're talking about versus perhaps, you know, more developed economies, like fewer consulting programs, or, you know, if you're an entrepreneur and you need, you know, to implement an HR management system and you want to hire a consultant, maybe you don't have as many options in the markets we're talking about as in the West. So that's one thing, you know, just perhaps a less developed market for services that entrepreneurs can tap.
Sonali adds that it's also about developing trust and using it as an asset.
So, you know, I trust the people in my network and therefore I can ask them, you know, to help me when I enter a new country. If I'm in South Africa and I want to enter into Nigeria, I can call up a fellow member and say, hey, can you introduce me to such and such? I'm trying to, you know, export more of my rubber gloves there, you know, for my hospital supply business. But it's also trust in terms of potential investors can know that if they're working with someone who's been part of a PACER, that they've almost been vetted, if you will, because there's a trust that people go through a robust, you know, long-term program, that they have this web of support, that it's almost like a little bit of a validation that we hope can help the investor, you know, feel good about lending or making an equity investment.
So let's move on to some of the challenges. And this is really about the underlying business model. The challenges of being a PACER in these emerging economies is quite significant, actually. Interested in, first of all, the underlying business model. It's not easy to fund this. I know in developed economies, it's quite hard to get these PACER, which we're now calling PACER-like organizations, working from a financial perspective. What are some of the challenges to trying to do this in emerging economies?
I think part of the challenge is whether you need to re-examine your strategy and where you're currently making an impact and where else you could make an impact. So I do think it takes a little bit of introspection and understanding, you know, your impact so far that you've been able to make as a support organization, but where else you think you could make it. So what is the demand from your participants? Do they have a need, you know, beyond what you've provided to them? And are you poised to serve that? And that might require re-examining your mission, your strategy, to see what your competencies are and see if you can kind of make an investment to focus on it. I mean, I think in the article, we offer kind of some baby steps of kind of low hanging fruit that you can perhaps consider deploying without any significant investment upfront. But I think it requires not just kind of deciding to tack on one service here or there, but perhaps re-examining your strategy, taking a look at what might be an area of opportunity that you think you could perhaps take advantage of.
When talking about challenges, Tim also addresses the elephant in the room, which is how you finance these operations.
You know, when we talk about challenges, there's always so much more that you can do and that you would like to do. And I think that's part of the challenge because the demand is so high. And then you have to look at your financial bottom line and what's possible. And I think within that, you see, a variation of using grants only up to philanthropic capital, maybe even having equity investment funds that, you know, plow some money into the companies. And then through that, generate some profits that then can be again used to expand or solidify the existing programming that Pacers do. And I think in finding that optimal funding model, that's a almost idiosyncratic, you know, organization specific challenge because they all start from different starting points initially, right? Like whether you have been endowed with something or whether you're trying to start from scratch. But the most important part is that, you know, you don't have to now straight away be a seed type of a pacer, but instead you can adapt ways of doing things that are relatively low cost. And I think one really fascinating organization here, for example, is the Harambians that created a community or a collective of sorts for high potential, high impact African entrepreneurs. They can operate in African societies or also outside of the continent. But ultimately, they have done such an amazing job at identifying these high potentials, if you will, and high impact entrepreneurs that now organizations, grant giving organizations and investors are coming to them and saying like, hey, I don't need to screen all those deals if I can, through you, get access to this amazing network of people that are really moving the needle. And then, you know, why don't we partner up, right? And that's how fellowships have emerged and how they now have an equity investment fund in which they're supporting their members and able to further upgrade the services that they offer. So it's an interesting approach that they have used that's worthwhile taking a look at.
And I think what really resonates for me in what you've been saying is that entrepreneurs need support in a moment of challenge or a moment of transition or a moment of crisis. And so I guess the question really is, how do you build this strong network through those moments when actually things are going okay, which could be 6 months, a year, 2 years, and then suddenly there's this transition. So just thoughts about how some of these pacer organizations are managing that challenge or could manage the challenge of member engagement.
I think from the perspective of Stanford Seed and those we interviewed, I think one important thread we saw was establishing high quality connections from the very beginning in the program. So there's a lot of kind of letting your guard down, having intense, you know, dinners, opening up personally, having a lot of bonding events at the beginning of a program so that you form really deep connections with one another from the get-go. That's been one element we've seen across those we interviewed, but also then staying in touch through peer support groups has been, you know, one of the common threads. And then to your question about what do you do when there's ups and downs and maybe you haven't tapped your network for a while. Absolutely. At Seed, we see kind of, you know, disengaged members, sporadically engaged members, regularly engaged members, and then kind of network leaders, right, who are champions of the organization and really activating the local alumni chapter or the member chapters and organizing events and things. But I think through that spectrum of engagement, you know, we know that folks can always come back if they need to. So entrepreneurs know they can come back to Seed if they need to. And what we saw during the pandemic was folks that had finished the program years before came back to listen in on webinars. They picked up the phone when we had volunteers call them for an emotional support sort of a program we called the Buddy Program. You know, we said every month we're just going to call every entrepreneur that is a member to say, how are you doing? You know, how's business? Is there anything you'd like to share? If at all we could help them. You know, we tried to point them to some services and support, but I think just being available and having established that trust from the very beginning of a program are two elements that I think have helped.
Yeah, I think an interesting dimension that Sonali alluded to is the dipping in and out of services, right? You have those champions, as she called them, that are heavily involved. And then you have those sporadic, you know, that whenever it hits their interest, they're available and they want to engage, or then in the times of heightened need, they're engaging. And I think while ultimately the model thrives off of those champions because they keep on adding value over sustained amounts of time, when you then see the spike of activity from a member who has been maybe a little bit more salient over time, that then also really speaks to the value that the PACER offers, that they have a support network that they can tap into and don't need to constantly be involved in it.
In the article, you acknowledge that PACERs can run the risk of favoring already successful entrepreneurs over those who are marginalized or struggling in some way. Could you talk more about that and if you see that as an issue?
Yeah, I think something we grapple with at Seed is, you know, we want to select the best companies for our program that have the most potential to scale further, but they need to be large enough to take advantage of all the services that Seed offers. And yet then are we sometimes not seeing, you know, the spectrum of companies out there, perhaps, you know, companies that have potential, but that haven't quite made it to the size we need them to be, or aren't quite ready, you know, for our services. Are we, you know, having a self-selection bias here and really, you know, recruiting companies that are strong and may not need our help quite as much? So I think that's a challenge that we have to kind of look inside ourselves and think about all the time. It can be that we don't see enough, you know, female-led companies if they haven't really had the chance to scale to the size we need them to be for our program, for example. So I think maintaining kind of diversity and accessing perhaps entrepreneurs that could benefit, but we're just not seeing because they're not quite there yet, that's one of the challenges that we see.
Yeah, just to add on, I think every time you select, there is someone in and someone out. And there is oftentimes, as we know, a lot of bias in how selection processes work. And I think that really can bias you towards selecting those that are already successful, and then you're a part of their journey, which then builds the image of your PACER, right? Hey, look at how great we're doing. But ultimately, you brought in organizations that were already great. How much of an impact did you really have? Is that question that it sort of raises. So I think the basic message there is just being aware of your bias is important, and then thinking about what makes up the magic in your organization and how can you work towards being more inclusive in the types of businesses you integrate, and then also ponder, if I start being more inclusive, how does that change the dynamics? If you start including more female leaders, you have to be also cognizant of power dynamics that now might be going on within your organization. If you include folks from a majority tribe and a minority tribe, you know, ethnic group, how can that impact the dynamics? And that's something that you then have to be also prepared for in managing it and making sure that every member is safe.
You've put forward a very compelling case for PACERs and this long-term support. Is the old model of acceleration dead? Is there any need for sort of accelerators, incubators, or do you think that really anyone in that space should be moving towards more of a PACER model?
I wouldn't say old models are dead. I wouldn't quite go that far. I would say it depends on the objective of your organization. So if you're an incubator and you're really just training startups, ideation and kind of going to market, then, you know, if that's your objective and you're meeting it successfully, whatever your metrics of success are, then perhaps that's enough. And if you're an accelerator and your goal is to get companies, you know, to grow by X percent within a year's time, or you want to take an equity stake in a couple of those firms and see them, you know, become the next unicorn, like maybe that's your model and that's your goal and that's okay. But if your objective is to kind of perhaps, you know, with Tim talking about the camel model or kind of cultivate more slow and steady growth, perhaps with a diverse group of companies where you know that they'll have ups and downs along the way, then perhaps a PACER model is something to consider, where growth may take time and you may want to be there in order to sustain that growth, even if it's at a slower and steady pace.
Yeah, just to double down on that, I don't think it's an either incubator, accelerator, or PACER. It's an and, right? I mean, it offers an additional support opportunity. Going back to the marathon metaphor, you know, you might feel a little bit down or whatever, you know, while you're running at minute 20 and you need a little boost, then you go for the incubator or accelerator, or you want someone, you know, who gives you the 3.5 hour mark. And so you kind of tag onto that person and push all the way through to meet your objective of completing the marathon in 3.5 hours. And so I think that's exactly kind of what it is, right? The entrepreneur self-selects into whatever their challenge is at the current moment, and having a richer and more diverse portfolio of entrepreneurial support organizations means that they can make informed choices for their own benefit.
What is your hope for what the world looks like when many, many people read this, say, this is brilliant, we want more PACERs in the world, and they're operating really effectively? What does the world look like from a positive impact perspective?
I hope that, as we're already seeing, that we can continue to close the gaps between all of the resources entrepreneurs have at their disposal to succeed and thrive, between, you know, developing markets and developed markets, so that there's really not so much of a gap in the future. And I think the PACER model is one opportunity to narrow those gaps, because we've seen research showing entrepreneurial support works. And so can you extend that impact over a longer time, not just working in the short term to give an entrepreneur a boost, but to give them that boost, you know, throughout the life cycle of their business or through the next enterprise that that person decides to found. And so I'm hopeful that this model can help continue to narrow the gap. We're seeing that gap narrow every day.
What would be your call to action for our listeners from this conversation?
Well, I think the first call to action, if you're an entrepreneur, is think about what current challenge you have. What are you up against for the next 2 to 3 years? And what type of organization, entrepreneurial support organization, is the right one for you? I think, just like you've said, Dan, the entrepreneurs that I've worked with, they're all part of 15, 20 accelerators, incubators in from Japan to the US to Europe to Latin America, Africa. There is so much out there, but very few of these opportunities are actually very highly meaningful, right? And I think doing a little bit of due diligence before you send out that application, and also a little bit of reckoning by yourself, what do I actually need? And what's that next sort of goal? And who do I need for that? Is it a gentle push, a nudge? Do I want to set goals to transform something that's a more longer term aim? And so I think my call to action to entrepreneurs would be to get a clearer sense of what's their profile of need or the challenge that they're up against.
Sonali adds that PACERs finding a common purpose with the organizations they support is key.
And the way our executive director talks about it is, you know, does your success matter to someone else besides you? And so just kind of being united a little bit in terms of supporting one another, but wanting yourself and others to achieve success, I think, is one theme that we've seen, and I think is an important element to all of this.
I think Sonali and Tim and their co-authors bring to light clear gaps in the entrepreneurial support ecosystem and play an important role in understanding solutions. I look forward to seeing how these ideas develop in the coming years. If you want to dive deeper into the topics discussed today, get a copy of the latest edition of SSIR and read the article titled Pacing Entrepreneurs to Success. A link to purchase the magazine is in our show notes. And of course, you'll find many other fascinating articles in there too. Before we go, we'd like to thank SSIR for the work that they do and for partnering with us in this series. If you love Mission to Scale, please recommend our show to a friend or colleague. You can subscribe or follow our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Mission to Scale is produced by Spring Impact and Human Group Media. If you want to learn more about our work at Spring Impact, visit springimpact.org and follow us at Spring Impact on Twitter. Thank you so much for joining us, and I'll catch you in our new episode next week.